Okay, so I would like to thank the alternative organizers for the invitation to speak. So today, as sort of a cosmologist visiting in on the concept of string phenomenology, I'd like to make a few comments about lessons learned from cosmology and how they might help string theory, and conversely, how string theory might help cosmology. So a rough outline. So first I want to just quickly review what we've heard a lot about here throughout the workshop, is how to build maybe successful inflation models in string theory, and the problem of moduli stabilization, which we've certainly heard a lot about over the last few weeks. Then I want to point out, use this as a motivation to maybe present what might be considered a problem and how this could be resolved by including dynamics in the process of moduli stabilization. And this will lead us to the idea of enhanced symmetry. And I'll explain what I mean by that. And then after we discuss, this will lead us to this idea of moduli trapping. And then I want to zoom in on sort of a very difficult challenge in this, in these toy models, which is addressing the problems with the dilaton and stabilizing the dilaton, which turns out to be especially challenging. And after we hopefully get through this, sort of the output of the stabilization mechanism is some light moduli. And in particular, if you build models in supergravity or string theory of inflation, you might expect the couplings of your theory to depend on such moduli. And if these couplings receive Hubble scale fluctuations during inflation, as we expect them to do, this can lead to a new way to generate density fluctuations. So I'll explain what I mean. And then I'll conclude. So as everyone here knows, the presence of light scalars is sort of a generic prediction of any theory with a lot of symmetry, extra dimensions, or brain model building. It's the generic consequence that we get lots of these light scalars. On the one hand, they're somewhat problematic. We can't have too many light scalars around in late times. They screw up fit force experiments in the very late universe. In the early universe, they can spoil inflation. And really ruin things. On the other hand, we need some light scalars around, such as the inflaton, which still sort of remains elusive in the context of UV completion. We also know that there's this dark energy today. Dark matter, it's been argued by some that dark matter, cold dark matter by itself, is not enough to explain the structure of galaxies, that we might need something like fifth force dark matter. So that's another place where scalars can be very useful. So as far as inflation goes, inflation is still sort of an idea or a paradigm that's in search of a fundamental theory. Over the years, there's been many attempts to get a sort of UV completion for inflation, or a motivation for where such a scalar comes from. And unfortunately, this is not a complete survey of all models. So over the years, as we've changed our ideas, we keep building and building. And I threw two of my favorites at the bottom, because these are sort of interesting, because as we introduced the idea of the string landscape, we can actually go back to the original idea, which was Gussold inflation. And we heard from Jim the other day about this idea of chain inflation, where you could have a series of these. So I guess the point is that we've learned a lot of things over the years, but there's still no convincing model of inflation from a fundamental theory. However, in an attempt to construct sort of a precise construction in string theory, by this time everyone's heard about KKLT, KKMMLT, this is the racetrack inflation model, and the reason I've listed these acronyms this way is you can see through time, the more realistic our model gets, perhaps the more difficult it gets, and the number of authors the most increasing. But in most of these models, the general setup is I start with some six-dimensional manifold that I need to compactify. I want to stabilize these moduli, and I do this by turning on some fluxes. We've heard a lot about this. And by wrapping these fluxes around various cycles, I can stabilize the structure, the overall size of the manifold, and then hopefully leave maybe one or two of these free to do some sort of inflation. So I'm not so much interested in this, since we've heard a lot about this, but generically in such models, you usually find stabilizing potentials through non-perturbative effects that often are drawn in potentials that look like this. And in some sense, these potentials, when you see them, aren't fair, because generally the height of this potential is very small compared to the overall scale of the problem you're looking at. In particular, if I took my moduli and I sit them at this minimum, then they would, of course, be stabilized. And I can speak of the metastability of such a state, calculate how long I would remain here, and I show that this time is much longer than the age of the universe, so I'm happy and I say it's stabilized. Of course, in real cosmology, we know that the early universe is a very hot place. Modes are generally very excited, and the typical kinetic energy of any field around would lie more up in this region here. So it becomes a challenge to explain, if I start up here on the potential, why I would not just overshoot this minimum. So what I plotted here, this is taken from a paper by Linde and Kalash. This is the potential for KGLT, this is a D3-D7 model, and this is sort of including the thermal effects on such a potential in these special cases. But generally, this is a generic problem that was pointed out in the cosmology context by Brustein and Steinhardt many years ago, and in the string theory context by Dine and Zeiberg, but it's called the overshoot problem. So the problem I want to try to address today is, one question is, why do we find ourselves in the minimum of this potential? And one thing I've been taught as a graduate student is you must postulate a symmetry. So the question is, can symmetries help us avoid this problem? So are there any questions so far?
So you're saying thermal effects actually remove that minimum? Is there an obvious reason why? Is there more like degrees of freedom or something?
Actually, I think the idea is it's more like the Kalman-Weinberg model where you would change the effective potential as you include the thermal effects. So yes, I would say more like degrees of freedom. This is sort of, I guess, a model-dependent thing they drew. I would just be more concerned that if I generically start here with some large kinetic energy, I won't find myself there. Yeah. Or if you like statistics, perhaps, it's more probable to find yourself here than here.
Right. Can you characterize the temperature for those curves?
Is that equivalent probably to asking the question, how do I calculate the finite temperature corrections to the KKLT setup? And I don't know how to do that, but maybe they do.
So are you saying these are just artistic?
For me, they are. For Andre, maybe not. Yeah.
But for Andre, are these supposed to represent the KKLT model or just some random one?
Well, my understanding was that this is supposed to be KKLT at finite temperature. The main argument is that in order to find yourself in this minimum, the Hubble scale during inflation has to be less than m3/2, which seems very unrealistic to say it, to understate it. But so my goal is just to ask, is there a reason why I would find myself located there dynamically? So to do this, I need to sort of motivate where the symmetry is coming from. Let me give you a brief review of strings on compactified on a circle. So in Jonathan Fang's talk, he sort of set the stage for this, except he focused on the vector degrees of freedom, whereas here I'm more concerned with the scalar. So of course, if I compactify a theory on a circle as a simple toy model, I get some overall scalar field that characterizes the radius of the compactification, and I get a vector associated with the compactification. So one thing that's sort of different in supergravity theories or string theories is the presence of flux. So for example, I get a chiral U1 theory instead of just a plane U1 theory. So this is sort of the supergravity picture of the low energy degrees of freedom. I would view phi as some flat direction, and I would have a problem because it doesn't have a potential, and the different values of phi would correspond to different values in the moduli space, and I would say that nothing determines the string vacuum, that this is degenerate. But then the observation is that if I go to the string theory itself and work in the CFT picture and calculate the mass spectrum of a string on the circle, then I find additional states, of course the massive states of the string, which should not be in the low energy theory since they have string scale masses. I integrate these out and focus on the low energy degrees of freedom because we like effective field theory. But one thing you miss if you restrict to the supergravity theory is you miss states that at special values of r, or in this case phi, these states can actually become massless. And so they become additional degrees of freedom you should include in the low energy theory. So for the example I've considered here, just a string on S1, there are in fact 8 new scalar degrees of freedom and 4 new vectors. If I go to the self-dual radius, or the fixed point of t-duality, which in this corresponds to r equals 1 or phi equals 0, and in that case, with a winding number, for example, plus or minus 2, this winding scalar will actually become massless. And so if I'm doing effective field theory correctly, I'll need to integrate these states back in. And so I guess the first little lesson in this toy model is that if I restrict my knowledge to supergravity effective actions and don't have an underlying knowledge of the string theory and the dynamics, I would miss these extra light degrees of freedom, which are certainly important. Of course, this isn't that unfamiliar. This is just the Higgs effect in string theory, where here it's the VEV of the radius, where I set my radius at, that's setting the mass of the extra degrees of freedom. So the reason I'm throwing around the word dynamics is, of course, in a real universe, we want to have this radius evolving in time, or if I switch to this field phi, the radion, I want phi to evolve in time. And so once I introduce a dynamical field, I have to worry about encountering such states. And so in particular, in the case of strings, or let's say heterotic strings on a six torus, there the enhanced symmetry would be enhanced gauge symmetry. As I go to the string scale, not the zero, but the string scale, the mass of these extra states go to zero, and this U1 chiral theory is lifted to an SU2 chiral theory with these extra degrees of freedom. Are there any questions about that? So this little toy model is not the exception, it's more of the rule. So some simple examples that come from string theory is if I consider heterotic strings on T6, I get enhanced gauge symmetry. This was shown long ago that heterotic strings on T6 are dual to type 2 strings on K3. And here, the symmetry is not an enhanced gauge symmetry, but one finds that the singular points on the K3 correspond to enhanced symmetry points. So this is a generic feature of these two string theories. Moreover, if I consider wrapped brains or strings on collapsing cycles, for example, Strominger showed long ago that if I consider a D3 wrapped on an S3, and I'm allowing the S3 to collapse, it's these light degrees of freedom associated with the D3 brain that are resolving the singularity in the conifold and give me the resolved conifold case. So it's another example of light degrees of freedom coming to play. And then maybe the simplest example is the idea of just two coincident brains. So I start with two separate U1s, and I have some open string stretched between them. And as this distance between the brains goes to zero, I get some U2 gauge theory. And the additional light degrees of freedom are just the open strings becoming light. So what I hope I can convince you of quickly is that this is a ubiquitous property of anything in string theory. And on the other hand, without an underlying knowledge of either D-brains, non-perturbative physics, or the string theory itself, we would miss these degrees of freedom if we just concentrate on any supergravity theory. Okay, so what? So the idea is that here's sort of a toy picture, or cartoon, of the moduli space of just this phi field. And so initially, naively, this is some flat direction. But the idea is that initially the moduli is rolling around in the moduli space, dominated by its kinetic energy. And this thing would just roll and roll and roll, maybe redshifted away by the expansion. But once it reaches this enhanced symmetry point, if these modes become massless, remember phi is providing an effective mass for chi. So I have sort of a system of equations that looks like this. And so working in the Hartree approximation, initially I had these heavy states, their expectation value would be zero, so that I integrated them out, and phi would just roam around the moduli space, which is this picture here. But once it encounters this enhanced symmetry point, then this mass becomes very light, and because of the time dependence of the mass, I can particle produce these states. And so this is...
Can you say that again? Which is the moduli? Which phi is the...
So phi is like the radius of the dimension, so it sets the mass for these chi states, which are like the winding mode in the S1 example. So as the time-dependent mass for chi evolves, as long as it evolves slowly enough, I won't excite any chi modes. But once this condition is violated, which is roughly the rate of change of the mass, when this becomes order one, then I can excite modes of chi, and they become important.
Phi goes to zero.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. So I've just rescaled R, so phi zero is the enhanced symmetry point. So the idea is, as I approach this point, I'll get this particle production of chi states, and then I will have chi's as phi continues on its path, and some of its energy will be lost to production. But then you can ask the question what this back reaction does to the motion of phi.
So aside from the enhanced symmetry effects, what are you envisioning the potential for phi to begin with?
Well, so in this simple toy model, I'm imagining that it's just a flat direction. If you add the potential, then it can certainly complicate things. In the case of the example I had originally with the non-perturbative effect, you might usually you find that this effect will overpower that, and it gives you an enveloping potential to stabilize you at that point and not overshoot. I'll put up a graph in a moment that illustrates it better.
So you're saying that you could let the potential for phi, or that you're assuming the potential for phi is a weak
Yeah, very shallow.
So you don't have to consider it here.
Yeah, since they're non-perturbative effects, generically, you might expect that.
And any minimum is not going to be determined by the potential. So where the phi ends up, it's not going to be determined by the potential. It's going to be determined by this dilemma.
Right. Well, in the very least, this sort of a cartoon. In the original potential I had up, you can imagine overshooting that, but then you've lost some kinetic energy as you're leaving the ESP, and then it will pull you back towards it. And this is the idea.
Problem is, potential is improved, maybe non-perturbative in the small end of the regime where it's valid, but of course the intense symmetry forces are often points where the radius is small, for example, and there the non-perturbative effects wouldn't necessarily be small.
Right. No, I agree. In fact, that will be sort of my conclusion I'll be pushed to. That's a good point. So here's, just the idea is I start with this equation of motion for phi. Initially, chi squared is zero, so I have some Hubble friction that could be around in a realistic cosmology model. But in general, phi is just following its classical motion. It encounters one of these ESP states. Particles are produced. So this is sort of a cartoon of what happens. So phi comes in, it passes this enhanced symmetry point, and it now a linear potential will be induced because of the presence of the chi particles, the density of particles created. Then it will go back for a second pass, but when it does that, it'll produce more particles, and this potential will keep raising until finally you're stuck localized around this phi point. So as far as particle production goes, you can use standard methods to calculate this. In a four-dimensional case, I guess I should have give credit to the people that did this. Okay, so the initial paper on moduli trapping was by Kaufman, Linde, Liu, Maloney, the Stanford group. And I did something small, independent. Then later, Sarah Cremonini here at the workshop and me extend this to the Dilton case, which I'll talk about shortly. And there's a paper coming out soon where we've generalized this to the case of the conifold, and we sort of summarize the whole approach, also addressing this question about a pre-existing potential. So in all these models thus far, it was assumed that there was no pre-existing potential, classically, for example. And in this paper, we sort of compare the two classical versus quantum trapping. Okay, so as far as the particle production goes, again, sort of you solve the chi equation of motion using the WKB approximation, and this is just the condition that it fails. But actually, for the cosmologists, this is actually just a special case of preheating in cosmology where the infotron rolls at the bottom and produces some particles. That's really what's being used here. And so there's methods created to address this in time-dependent backgrounds. What you find is that the number of modes produced per k goes something like this. So this is very intuitive. The larger momentum modes are not favored. So this is the three-dimensional momentum of the particles. So smaller, it favors long wavelength, small momentum. The stronger the coupling is, the more production I get, and the more initial velocity I have, of course, the more particles I get. So it's a good intuitive check. In the case of the Kaufman paper, they were looking at D-brain systems. So in that case, which is different than the case I looked at with the radion, in the D-brain system, the brains don't actually have to hit head-on and pass directly through this point. They can miss by an impact parameter. And so then that will introduce another factor, depending on how close you come to the CSP. But so the bottom line is that once you calculate this, and in the presence of these new particles, you can reevaluate chi squared, which is sort of a messy calculation. But the upshot is that in addition to the tree level equation of motion, you get this correction term, which is a constant negative force. It's a force always pulling you back towards the ESP. And this, of course, this absolute value sign is important because that means that I'm always getting taken back towards the minimum at phi equals zero. Of course, at phi equals zero, you can't really trust anything I'm saying here. And so that's the best you can really say is that this leads you towards these enhanced symmetry points. Once you're there, it gets very complicated. Just one final comment. Another thing that makes this production is very efficient, and as you pass through this ESP, this is a graph of the non-adiabaticity, and you can see that it's sharply peaked around the value phi equals zero. So in that sense, this is sort of an instantaneous event where you throw out a bunch of chi particles and then you move on. So it's only in this regime where the approximation is breaks down the WKB approximation. So are there any questions about that? Okay, so what I hope this toy model convinced you of is that if we're going to study dynamics of moduli, we should be careful and watch out for these light degrees of freedom associated with this enhanced symmetry. And from this sort of initial study, what we learn is that these enhanced symmetry points seem to be attractors on the moduli space. So they seem to be more favored dynamically than other points in the landscape. The other thing that was pointed out by Dine some time ago was if you found yourself at these enhanced symmetry points, it would be nice, because during a phase transition, for example, from a de Sitter phase to what follows, a radiation phase, usually you worry about the moduli problem, that is the low energy effective minimum of the moduli potential will be shifted during a phase transition. But in this case, you're protected by a symmetry, so you will have the same low energy minimum, and these moduli will not oscillate about the minimum, so they don't get displaced. So this could address the moduli problem. What's also interesting from a stringy point of view is that most, at least in the case of the heterotic string, these enhanced symmetry points were at fixed points of duality, in that case, t-duality. And this leads me to the next part, which is you might conjecture that for the case of the dilaton, you might expect to find it at a fixed point of s-duality. So the other thing we'll see is I'll show you some graphs where if you combine these trapping effects I just showed along with gravity, it can actually get quite complicated, and you can, for example, Hubble damping can slow you before you get to the enhanced symmetry point. It's messy, but the dynamics can actually generate small numbers. So first...
So I have a question. I actually may have missed this point, but these are all advantages in the enhanced symmetry point. There might be disadvantages, too, because after all, we're trying to stabilize moduli and get rid of light fields, and as you say, there are extra light fields in enhanced symmetry points.
That's right. No, I didn't. So that's going to motivate the second part of my talk, because what I'm generically predicting are some light scalars, but there could be many light scalars, and so this certainly is not the complete story. So that's right. I guess the main lesson here is dynamics makes a difference, but is it good or bad? I'm not sure. So the point of view of the Stanford group was that since I see you might say that SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 is a high amount of symmetry, and this is why I see it. But you're still going to need to address then stabilizing these moduli and giving them masses. And so their point was that beauty is attractive, but that might not be so attractive. So,
yeah. If you do stabilize moduli, it might change a lot of the details of moduli.
Yeah. So, no, I agree totally. So just as a quick review. So if I consider the heterotic string on T6, the mass of these states, for example, of a Kaluza-Klein mode and a winding mode that we were looking at that has enhanced symmetry had the form like this. So if I believe in the concept that M-theory should have 11-dimensional Poincaré invariants, you might just look at this and say it's trivial that if the dilaton is associated with some 11th direction of some circle in, say, type 2A theory being extended to M-theory, you might just naively expect that R11 would provide some sort of state that will couple to the dilaton and stabilize it. But there's a lot of immediate problems with that, especially if you want to do some sort of supergravity analysis. So one thing I didn't mention, but you have to do when you do these calculations, is in the case of the torus, you need to have the dilaton such that the string coupling is much less than 1, so you have parametric control over the supergravity approximation. So if I did convince you that I should be stabilizing all the radii at the self-dual radius, then this would also say that the dilaton goes towards strong coupling where I can't trust anything. So this is already a problem, and the question is how to deal with that. And then just the fact that M-theory itself is sort of elusive is another challenge. So the plan of attack is that given some knowledge of 11-dimensional supergravity massless modes, we want to find critical points where these additional states could live. In the string theory case, this meant go to the CFT or the string theory picture, calculate the mass spectrum, and locate these states. In M theory, it's not clear what to do. One thing you could do is construct string states and lift them. The other thing you could do is try to go to supermembrane theory and calculate the mass spectrum of that. So what you quickly learn in supermembrane theory is you basically can't quantize the theory, You come up with states that don't, upon reduction, don't give you string states. And also the idea of a t-duality, which would be realized presumably as s-duality in the low theory, is not a well-understood idea in supermembrane theory. So in other words, supermembrane theory is difficult and not well-developed. However, there's been a lot of work by Stateland and Russo who were able to show that in certain limits, you can quantize the theory. So crudely speaking, the idea is that if I take some supermembrane, I could think of some two-dimensional membrane, and I wrap it on some cycles and then take those cycles to be large, then I have some sort of control. And furthermore, the nonlinearities in the theory come from the interactions or the fact in some sense that you have a three-dimensional theory instead of a simple two-dimensional theory in the case of the string. So when I take the large torus limit, I can decouple these oscillator modes and actually quantize those states. So the key is that you find some BPS state that I know will not receive corrections for any value of R11. And so then if I find the state that I'm looking for at some large value of R11, I can extrapolate this to any value of R11, in particular R11 equals 1. And this is the idea of how you might get some knowledge coming from supermembrane theory. And then another check you can do is you can try to reduce these states and then match them to the 10-dimensional string theory states. So if anything, sort of the summary of this slide is it's hard to deal with supermembrane theory and it's hard to understand M-theory states. But we will try anyway. So if you read a lot of the work of Stateland and Russo, which is quite intense, you find that there is such a state that may exist, which is basically can be understood as an M2 brain non-threshold bound state with 11-dimensional gravitational wave. So that doesn't sound too exciting, but the basic notion is that just as in the case of the heterotic string, we had some Kluze-Klein mode and we had it in a bound state with some winding momentum. So this is the sort of the natural generalization to 11 dimensions. Here, this is the gravitational wave, looks like a Kluze-Klein mode in 10 dimensions. And I have some M2 brain wrapped on two cycles. So I've performed a little trick in writing this to make it a little more straightforward. You can, you're going to wrap the M2 brain, of course, on two cycles, R11 and say R10, but you can absorb that to get some overall mass scale for the membrane. And for those not that familiar with M theory, if I reduce this on a type 2B theory, what I find is a fundamental string D1, or in other words, a PQ string bound state. Whereas if I reduce this on 2A theory, I find some fundamental string bound with a D0 brain. So this all sounds pretty exotic, but the idea is that this is hopefully a state that mass depends on the value of R11 or the dilaton, and this would trap the dilaton at some fixed point of, say, S-duality. So are there any questions about that? Okay, so to cut to the chase, if you calculate the production of such states, you find some number per mode similar to what I found in the string case, except with the following properties. So first let me compare this to what we had before. So H here is just some flux that was associated with the background. So you see that the behavior with the flux. Again, if I have small momentum, these modes are favored. This is the three-dimensional momentum of these states. And I have this Planck scale suppression going along with that. But the real catch is that here I have the momentum number and the winding number of this bound state. So you see that if I do not have states such that n equals minus w, for example, then these are Planck scale suppressed. And in fact, if I rescale this, this would just be string scale suppressed. So in other words, this is just the statement that these states are not going to be produced because they're too heavy unless I can find states where n equals minus w. Okay, so to summarize quickly, the problem is that in type 2 theories, you don't have such states. In type 2 theories, the reason in the heterotic theory we had these states was the tachyon charge that was existing because you had, for example, heterotic strings. In the type 2 theory, we have too much symmetry to do this. So in summary, skipping over sort of the technical details, these states should exist, you would think they would exist, but they're difficult to find. And if they did exist, then we might think that something similar like the heterotic string case would be true. Why should you believe in this? Well, if you considered heterotic M theory, you might think you might get such states, because then you wouldn't be matching to the n equals 2 case. And the other case that you might wonder about is in the type 2 case, we learned that the K3 manifold was the right one to compactify on. The singularities gave us these enhanced symmetry points. So you might expect that such states would come from this. But the main motivation for believing in such states is this idea that when we looked at the supergravity BPS states, in the case of the heterodox string, we found states that were less than the mass of the supergravity BPS states. So there's actually a conjecture by Vaffa that in all string cases, we should find states with masses who's below the supergravity BPS spectrum. And if that's true, then such states should exist. And the picture you might find is something like this. So if this is the famous amoeba diagram, and with my perturbative expansions, and what this enhanced symmetry would seem to suggest, if you push it to its max, is that the attraction should be towards the center of the moduli space, essentially where we can't calculate anything. So sort of the point of the slide is that we need to do more work. Yes?
So are you saying that even in type 2, you think there may be states which violate this BPS bound?
Well, presumably, from the heterodox, since I know heterodox on T6 is dual to type 2 on K3,
yeah,
then the enhanced symmetry states there would be at the singularities of the K3. And so you should have the same picture that in type 2 you're attracted to special points. Whether they match with the self-dual radius or what in the heterodox picture, I don't know.
You're talking now about it. I mean, your first part of the talk was reviewing the situation that we do understand, the ordinary T6,
right,
when you have a hand symmetry goes to singularities of the K3.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're asking about the 11th direction, that there could be a similar hand symmetry associated with that. That, in a way, is not going to be a singularity of the K3.
No, sure. No. Right. So, for example, with heterodic M theory, I'm on an interval, so I'm not going to have winding states. I've been told by Simeon Hellerman that most likely this can be on some Klein bottle compactification, but that's a little exotic for me. So I'm not sure. I just if you believe in things like Poincaré invariants, you might just believe that why is the 11th dimension special? But it's far from evident. I will give you that.
Enhanced symmetry points, also gauge symmetries?
In the case of the heterodox string, it was a gauge symmetry, but not in the case of type 2. So.
In the case of type 2?
These are stable massive states, right? And if the other configuration doesn't not take a decay, then they no longer would attract you to anywhere.
Right.
So,
then
you get they would exist if you had enough supersymmetry to have a BPS spectrum.
One thing I don't understand about Vaffa's argument is there's the supergravity BPS states, but then in the case of the heterodox string, the mass states I wrote down were still BPS. They were just string theory BPS states, so I don't understand the difference, but yeah, certainly if they decay. Of course, as a cosmologist, when I hear decay, I get excited. But so this doesn't stop me from, this didn't stop us from saying, okay, so such states exist. It's still interesting just to show the complicated behavior you can have if you have multiple cases. So for example, here's a plot of two of these dimensions. I'm allowing two dimensions with enhanced symmetry states. So you see that there's this complicated oscillatory behavior that asymptotically goes to this fixed value at 1, which corresponds to the ESP. But you see that these aren't numerical errors, they're actually modulations that correspond to the behavior of the other field. So that, as a cosmologist, you might hope that these could give you some sort of signature. But what's perhaps more interesting or disturbing is if I move over to here, this was for some set of initial conditions. But in general, if I allow my Hubble friction to just do whatever it will do, this is another example of where I have some extra one dimension and then some R11. Of course, this also would hold for the heterodic string. You'd find similar behavior. So gravity causes this to actually become fixed slightly above the ESP, and this one slightly below the ESP, and you generate this hierarchy between the sizes of the dimensions. Just by turning on gravity, just by turning on some dynamics of these moduli fields, not taking them to be static constant values. So the only thing this is sort of good for is suggesting that dynamics, gravity play an interesting role. And here you see This is the trapping time based on if I turn how much Hubble friction I allow for. So the more I turn on gravity, the longer it takes for the trapping, which is another sort of generic result you see in all these models.
If you visualize the lower one, are they actually the same values on the right-hand side? So there's a symmetric about the self-dual point.
That's nice. I never thought about that before. No, that's a nice observation. Yeah. So don't take this too seriously. Just the idea is that maybe the message is we should study dynamics more. Okay, so I hope on some level at least I've convinced you that dynamics, gravity, and hidden states can make the landscape a very complicated place to live, and there's lots of work to be done. In particular, it would be nice to better understand string solutions with dynamics and time-dependent backgrounds. And maybe before we understand this, it's a little early to speak about other stuff. So now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about something related but somewhat completely different. And this is the idea of modulated perturbations, which is based on work some time ago by Diwali and Kaufman in the context of reheating, but I'll explain what I mean by that. Okay, so what we saw from the last argument was that it's quite easy to have some light scalars around before inflation takes place. So the idea behind modulated perturbations is that if I have some inflaton dominating the energy density and driving inflation, I can still have these extra moduli fields around. And in particular, I can have them determining the couplings for the inflaton or fields that it will later couple to for preheating. So in particular, if I have any field around with a mass less than the Hubble scale during inflation, this field will get Hubble scale fluctuations. And this is a generic property. So, for example, you can imagine writing down some theory for the inflaton where the mass and the coupling depend on chi. And the argument first put out by the Diwali group was that if I allow fluctuations in this chi field during inflation, this will in turn give me fluctuations in the parameters of the scalar field theory, such as the coupling, which in turn will control the way processes end at the end of inflation. So this gives you another way to get density perturbations or temperature anisotropies without actually needing the fluctuations just from the inflaton. So of course we like the inflaton field. It generates a scale invariant spectrum, a nearly Gaussian spectrum. But this gives you an alternative way to generate the same spectrum using these moduli.
This is now what's called the curvatron, but that has the same objective, is that right?
That's right. There's small, subtle differences. So the idea is that, the first idea is that this may give us another way to generate density and temperature fluctuations. Because these fluctuations are coming to these fields that determine the couplings during inflation, it's a causal process. It's not some acausal statement. And they should be nearly Gaussian, just as the other fields are nearly Gaussian. So just to mention some processes that you have in mind, preheating and reheating depend strongly on the values of the couplings. So this is one place you have changes. And another one that has not really been explored at all, as far as I know, is the concept of baryogenesis, which is something I'm interested in looking at. So let me quickly remind you about hybrid inflation. This is a typical potential for hybrid inflation. You have some field phi that initially drives the inflation. I don't know if you can see this picture, but you go down to some critical point, phi c, which is determined by the values of these couplings in the action, and at which point, when phi reaches this point, sigma, which is the waterfall field, which is responsible for ending inflation and leading to preheating, it gets a negative mass squared once phi reaches this value, so this inflation will end by tachyonic preheating, where tachyon here just means that you have a negative mass squared. So one reason for choosing this model is it makes the computation simpler. So these are plots of the equation of state for various sets of parameters for the transition in this model, and you can see that this transition is very fast in time. So if I'm measuring with gravitational wavelengths, Hubble scale wavelengths, what I'm going to see is that this transition will be essentially instantaneous. One minute I'm inflation, and the next minute I'm in a radiation-dominated universe, effectively.
What are those curves?
Sorry, so like this is p equals 1/3 rho. So So this is radiation here. And then inflationary equation state on this minus one would be down here. And you see the transition, just the only point here is that the transition is very rapid. So I can treat this as sort of an instantaneous process. So in other words, I'm inflating, and then there's a quick drop, and I'm left with a bath of radiation. So from a gravitational point of view, I just think that the equation of state jumped. And it will jump at this value by C. So the idea behind the modulated perturbations would be to have some field dependence in the coupling G, and therefore this transition point by C will not be the same in every place. So because of the fluctuations in chi, I get fluctuations in G, which give me fluctuations in where and when inflation ends, in addition to the usual fluctuations coming from just the behavior of phi. So this is, at this point, this is just some toy model I've written down. But for an example of where you can find such behavior is if you, for example, look at D-term inflation with non-trivial gauge kinetic functions, you quite generically will get, you can get models that look like this. That's just one example. So are there any questions about that?
Is this case being worked out?
Or? Yeah, this is actually from a paper, again, I probably... Yes. That's in this paper here by Kaufman.
So this adds to the density perturbations that you would have had normally.
Right. I'll show precisely how it adds also. Maybe, perhaps alternatively, you can turn this argument around, and instead of trying to generate curvature perturbations by finding some exotic model in string theory, you could alternatively say, if I'm given some model in string theory, at the end we can use the CMB to put constraints on how much this coupling can fluctuate. And so it tells you where to look, and if you like, the landscape. So the way you can treat this problem that's kind of nice is by the idea of Israel matching conditions. So firstly, if we're looking at a fluid here that has no anisotropic stress, so the scalar metric fluctuations are all characterized by sort of this Newtonian potential phi, and the tensor perturbations are just the graviton, this hij, which has two polarizations. So this is the fluctuations in the metric. And here A squared is the background scale factor. So the Israel matching prescription can be illustrated by this cartoon. So this surface is some surface transition. So this is a complicated problem in GR in the sense that the way I slice space and time is not unique, and there's issues of gauge dependence, which is just the ability to do coordinate transformations. So when I'm taking one slice here to some other observer, it can appear like this. So there's some subtleties there. Which I won't go into, except to say that it's tricky. The main consequence is when I'm choosing this surface, I need to choose it so the physics tells me, dictates what surface I choose. In other words, what slicing I choose. And I'll say something more about that in a moment. But the idea behind the junction conditions is I just need to match the induced metric across this jump and the extrinsic curvature, which in terms of the inflation theory just means that I match the scale factor and the Hubble scale across the jump. They're continuous, whereas, for example, H dot is not, and the time will not be either. And then in terms of perturbations, I have these conditions. So the graviton and its derivative are continuous, and the scalar fluctuation is continuous. So the idea is that I'm going to start in some de Sitter part, p equals minus rho, with some metric fluctuation, and as I go to cross this junction, I'll get a contribution that I had before, and then I'll pick up a contribution from the surface so that the metric fluctuation on this side will be enhanced, and we'll see that. So are there any questions about that?
You're not putting a delta function source on the surface, are you? You're just simply matching.
No, but that I think is more interesting. No, I'm just...
I wonder what it would be such a thing if you just could write you according to that equation.
Yes, I don't have any brains or anything, but so for the standard case of hybrid inflation, the physics that is dictated to me is I want to make this transition on a surface of constant phi, which was set by phi c. So I choose this parameter, the slice in Q, to be phi minus phi c, and so I'm ending the inflation era on a surface of constant scalar field. So the reason I'm bringing this up is, for example, in cases like the ekpyrotic scenario, you must choose the slicing on a constant energy density surface. So the physics dictates what you need to choose. In this case, it's pretty straightforward. So the fluctuations, I'm only allowing fluctuations in phi, so I'm doing the usual story here. And then you find that the metric perturbation, or the fluctuations in the metric after the transition and the radiation era, are given by the primordial contribution from the quasi-de Sitter space, plus this extra factor that came from the transition surface. And when you do this and you plug in these values, p plus and p minus are just factors related to the scale factor, you find that the metric perturbation after is enhanced by this large factor of 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is the slow roll parameter. Alternatively, epsilon is how far you are from a de Sitter space. So you can see in the case of exactly de Sitter space, epsilon would be 0, and this would be infinite, and you would have a problem. So it's important it's not exactly de Sitter. And this also sort of illustrates a general concept of inflation. The reason I get an observable metric perturbation that I can then relate to things like the temperature fluctuations of the CMB is because of this transition from a quasi-de Sitter space to something else that doesn't have the same equation of state. So in other words, in a pure de Sitter space, you don't have scalar metric fluctuations. That's kind of an aside. But so this is the usual argument for hyperinflation.
Epsilon is a slow roll parameter?
Right.
How small does that have to be to get 60 equations?
I usually don't think of it in that way. But
is 5 plus much bigger than 5 minus?
Yeah, that's the point. No. Sorry. So epsilon has to be much, much less than 1.
Okay.
Right. Yes, to get the right number of E folding.
So
sorry.
Right.
So there's this enhancement when you cross from one, the de Sitter phase to the radiation phase.
Sorry, I'm just missing the mechanics here. Your boundary conditions at your junction, you said the metric is continuous. So why, if the metric perturbation is 5 plus on one side and 5 minus on the other side,
this is a bad pedagogy. So the point is that, for example, the time jumps, and the derivative of phi jumps. And so when you say matching condition, what you really mean is you mean that phi at the time of the transition, these two phis are equal, but at some later time they're not equal, and so you have to. So these bracket expressions I put up, I find this confusing myself. So these bracket conditions, this is to be evaluated at the time of crossing, of course. And then at some later time, you're going to get some. But the jump comes from the jump in the time. So when I have one time here, but then when over here, this time is not this time. The time actually undergoes a jump.
Well, that's just an important choice.
That's right.
But does that mean that in your next slide, when you say
this is the metric fluctuation evaluated at the jump. That's what I mean by star.
Right.
And this means that, so yeah, it's constant in time. So in fact, I this is for all later times. And I've done an approximation here. There's some other junk that's here, but at late times it doesn't matter. So there's some things here that go like T star over T, and when I take T to be much greater than T star, it goes away. And is that answer your question?
It's really phi plus in the late time.
Yes, late in the radiation phase.
Okay.
I should put that. I was trying to be fast.
It's not a constant year to jump.
Yeah, in fact, this is kind of nonsensical because I have a function of time equals a constant. Yeah. But yeah, no. So it asymptotically approaches this. Sorry. So the case of modulated perturbations, then, given the past argument, is sort of straightforward. So now our surface will fluctuate with the values of chi, this critical point when we end. And so then the fluctuations of the surface will take this form, and we'll have this extra contribution from the fluctuations of chi. So then I can just plug this into the formula again to find the metric perturbation afterwards. And what I find is this additional contribution that I've denoted delta phi plus here, which depends on the fluctuations of the scalar field chi. And again, I still find this 1 over epsilon-like behavior, which will lead to enhancement. So this is an observable signature. So So in some sense, the way to view this is this surface will have fluctuations that depend on the scalar fold chi. So are there any questions? So in principle, hybrid inflation was a very simple case to consider because we know hybrid inflation ends on this critical value phi. But for example, something like chaotic inflation is a little more challenging, even though it's a little more generic, because in that case, it's not so straightforward how to choose the matching surface, since the end of roughly the end of chaotic inflation happens at 0.3 m Planck. So there's not much room for moduli dependence. So this is sort of one of the ongoing things that people are trying to understand. So at the end of the day, skipping a lot of details, the power spectrum you'll get out for this modulated hybrid inflation. So this, ignoring this contribution, this is the standard contribution from hybrid inflation. So the scalar tilt, or how far away you are from the scale invariant spectrum, is given by this, where eta and epsilon are the slow roll parameters. So roughly eta is the curvature of the potential, and epsilon is the slope. And then in addition to this normal contribution that you get from hybrid inflation, you get this additional contribution coming from the fluctuations of the scalar field. And I've written it in terms of the mass of the chi field that we had before, ratioed over the Hubble scale. So in other words, if the mass of the field is much larger than the Hubble scale, this isn't a big deal. In fact, it won't really fluctuate. But if the mass is much less than h, then we do get fluctuations. And you get an additional contribution to the scalar tilt. And furthermore, maybe one of the more interesting things of the model is that if I calculate this thing, the ratio of gravity waves to the scalar fluctuations, this tensor to scalar ratio, typically in string models is not observable because of the energy scales involved. But depending on the details of this model and how phi changes, you could actually make this ratio observable. So this is sort of a plot of the WMAP3 data. So these dots represent different simple models of chaotic inflation, like lambda phi to the fourth and m squared phi squared. So I thought these graphs actually were pretty interesting when I first read the paper, because it seems that lambda phi to the fourth is ruled out, and the m squared phi squared model looks really good. And here you have, this is the tensor to scalar ratio on this axis, and you have the scalar tilt on this axis. So another conclusion is that the Harrison-Zeldovich, which was the original scalar invariant spectrum proposed, this is ruled out. But after spending 3 weeks in Florence, Italy, I learned that these graphs are perhaps a bit misleading, because you have 8 degenerate parameters, and these are sort of fittings to get you these sort of conclusions to show you that WMAP3 got results WMAP1 didn't. And maybe, so if you ask the experts, usually they say that there's really not much to draw from this. The other thing I was excited about is there's graphs that said there was running in the spectral index, but that's only if you make there be running in the spectral index. So I guess the whole thing is that there's still a lot to be done with the data, and there's still a lot for string theorists to do with cosmology. But anyway, one challenge, though, that's been pointed out is observing this tensor to scalar ratio. So it's been argued that most generic string models will put you somewhere down at zero, and even though that's okay, it's not very nice if you want to distinguish string theory models from some other just generic models or low-scale models. So one thing to really focus on if you're a cosmologist or a string cosmologist is to try to make this ratio observable. This might be one way to do it. Joe mentioned the curvaton scenario. That actually gives a different tensor to scalar ratio, but it also makes it observable. In some sense, the reason these things are observable is because the physics that's giving you these perturbations come late during inflation instead of 60 E foldings before the end. And then furthermore, I should mention several other string models that might give observable signatures. If you have fast roll inflation or DBI inflation, where you roll quickly down the potential, this can also change the spectrum. And generically, sort of, if you have any hydrodynamical fluid that is describing inflation, the sound speed will necessarily occur in this ratio, and that's really where you can get an observational difference with the tensor to scalar ratio. Okay, so to conclude, so I hope I convince you on some level that just sort of an initial investigation into dynamics of moduli on the landscape sort of have interesting implications, and hopefully we can is in desires further study. In particular, moduli trapping suggests a dynamical selection principle might be worth a closer look, even though it's far from complete. And this was sort of a low energy effective field theory approach, and maybe a time dependence and string theory would have more to say. Fluctuations in these light scalars that we generically got from the moduli trapping, or just in general from flat directions, can affect things such as inflation with modulated perturbations. Furthermore, you might ask about baryogenesis, since there's certainly coupling dependence there. Could you have variations in baryogenesis processes? And this idea that we can make the tensor to scalar ratio observable. So it's an exciting time to do string cosmology. Thank you.
This point about making R observable. On your formula on the previous slide, it looked like that extra term was always decreasing R. R just starts it's epsilon, and then it defines how it always is.
Yeah, I'm confusing a paper I just wrote with this. That's correct. So the reason that this is interesting here and observable is not what I was saying. Instead, it's there's this consistency condition, of course, that I can have the tensor, I can measure this, well, I can predict this tensor ratio, this scalar ratio, and that should equal this R, which can be found from a different method. And there's this consistency condition with WMAP that these two numbers should equal each other. And this is an example of where they do not equal each other. I was confusing this with other work, which I will now advertise, inflation without inflatons, where basically if you try to do inflation with fluids, as I was mentioning, you'll get some factor of the sound speed that sits here. And that factor can be different than one. It could be quite large, and that's how you can get observable R. So thank you for your question. Yeah, that was
so I thought maybe you're going to come back to this point about if you have the enhanced symmetry point that you may have light scalars, or we don't see these light scalars. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, one argument is that if some of these light scalars were the ones in the inflation model I was talking about, then that's why you get fluctuated, modulated perturbations. But in general, moduli trapping is incomplete because we need to give masses to these scalars. All it's really telling us is that these are preferred places in the landscape, if you like to look at it that way. But that's not enough. I mean, there's still lots to ask.
What light is light coming in?
That's a good question. So, here, for me, since I'm a cosmologist, my point of view on it is that this Hubble friction is not a non-trivial factor, and it needs to be accounted for. And so then it becomes a function of initial conditions. If you just look at it from a field theory point of view, you should probably be at zero, so these are massless. But if you put in this factor of gravity and damping as you try to approach ESP or as you're oscillating around it, you can pretty much, you give me an initial condition, I can give you a mass anywhere between the string scale to zero. So, and it goes back to this picture with the string on a circle. If I give it a VeV, I can give it any VeV and it would, so maybe gravity determines the VeV. So, but yeah, so I can't really answer that question yet.
Start again.